Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and it's January 7th, 2012. Wish all of us a happy new year. I hope this is a profoundly important year in the history of humankind. There's been such build-up to the 2012 phenomena or non-phenomena, and we're now in that year, and it certainly seems on so many fronts humankind is facing crises and tragedies around the world. We certainly live in a totally chaotic new world psychiatric disordered society with wars and poisonings and such terrible things going on around the world and in our own nations. Seems events are building towards quite climactic changes of one sort or another. And I think in ways we live in perilous times. And at the same time, there are hopes of possibilities of change, I think, as people around the world understand more and more deeply what the crisis of humankind involves. And people are waking up to the frauds of history and our governments and so on. So hopefully 2012 will be a year where the tide turns on these people. And we somehow, planetary citizens, we take back our countries and world from and bring about deeper change in the life of humankind upon this planet. I would like to apologize that I didn't have a show last week. It was Christmas Eve, and in a way, Jim wasn't available, and I didn't have the heart myself, in a way, to have a show. I was feeling down, and this last year has been a difficult year for me in ways. People who follow the show will know that I lost my sweetheart earlier in the year, in May. My partner, Karen, had died. And suddenly and unexpectedly at home. So that has been hard to kind of get through that and keep going and keep the faith and carry forward the type of work that I was involved with Karen as well. Karen and I had woken up in 2006 when we showed a movie about 9/11. And I could see immediately that we'd been deceived. I had no idea really how it all worked or who did it or anything like that, but I could see there had been a major public deception around the 9/11 events. And that kind of precipitated us into watching too many internet movies, and you learn more and more about all the aspects of, you know, the conspiracies of history and all the deviousness that goes on nationally and internationally. And in a way, as you open up to it, it gets deeper and deeper and more horrifying in a way. The kind of immensity and the scale of human suffering and tragedy around the world and abuse of people and so on. And it's like the values of spirituality and the values of humanity are just completely lost in this kind of chaotic and deviant world order that's emerging throughout the world. So I think we are in a period where the awareness of these problems and the extent of these problems and the history of, I believe it's possible. And when I had revelations, what I felt at the time in August of 2006, and I had I experienced like what I would describe as higher states of consciousness, or had flashes of these things anyway, through a period of time. And at that time, I kind of wrote the almost poetic script, which I which I put up on my website about how about 9/11 and how it was going to come undone, that these people would face justice for what they had done and be exposed, and that we, in a way, would turn the corner on these psychopaths. And my feeling was that by 2012. And so I felt in 2006, I got to make it through alive to 2012 and see what happens. So this year, I hope there is a change. I hope that somehow people on a grassroots level begin to realize we've got to start doing something. We're in serious trouble. And it's not just trouble, you know, for ourselves, but it's trouble for our children, and it's trouble for our grandchildren. We're in very serious times. The poisoning of the population through different means, the intensification of wars and American imperialism and through the Middle East, and the role of Israel in all of this nightmare. These things are just such atrocious crimes against humanity, and it's all so tragic and unnecessary. It's amazing. People say, I guess some people would say it's satanic. It's a satanic or Luciferian New World Order system. But the cruelty of it is unspeakable. It really is. Jim and I have talked about Beelzebub's tales, where Beelzebub was supposed to have been this higher being that kind of fell from grace, and he was exiled to our solar system. And he lived on the planet Mars, and he observed human beings through the centuries. And he observed things he had never observed before, which were these horrific processes of reciprocal self-destruction, where masses of people go out and murder each other and destroy the fruits of earlier civilizations and such. And this madness runs through the history of humankind. And we certainly see it alive and well today in the world, when we could have had a civilized society if we had used the technologies available and used them in productive ways, and put monies into building our nations and the new technologies, instead of putting the monies into wars and destruction and conquest and ownership of the assets of foreign peoples. It's so, the life of humankind is like a cosmic tragedy. So hopefully 2012, you know, hopefully we pray that something turns, or we do something ourselves to manifest our love and will in the world, to try to oppose this satanic, psychiatrically disordered system being imposed upon us. And I'm sorry in many ways for the people involved in it, who themselves are all kinds of victims in other ways, and become part of something that they had no idea, they didn't fully understand at all, and what they were involved in. And then they become blackmailed or threatened and so on. It's really very tragic also for them, in the way the elites and their servants are, you know, they suffer in a different kind of way. There's something lacking in their soul and heart dimensions, that somehow they can do such unspeakably cruel things and bring about such injustice through the world. They have no feeling or empathy for other human beings. And in a way, it's a lower type of psychiatric disorder, where the person's false egoism is so dominant in their psyche. And Gurdjieff has a special term. He calls them husnamuses. People who lack the divine impulse of conscience. Because most people couldn't do, like, I look, how do these people fly these airplanes and dump all these poisons on everybody, like aluminum and barium and strontium, and they poison the whole populations from the skies? How do people do that? Like, how do they justify it in their own minds? Because in a way, there's something lacking in the heart development of people. And your heart development is related to your soul life. And that's in part what the Zero Point Radio Show is all about. Like, the main teaching that Jim and I've offered through the years is about the origins of human consciousness and the I experience have to do with the heart. And this is taught throughout different mystical teachings. The self is within the heart. In Judaism, they say the truth is under your nose the whole time. But the false ego, the mind, is centered in the head. And people who become like egomaniacs, their consciousness shifts to this false center in the mind, in the head. And they don't have proper emotional and soul development. So anyway, one of the aims of the Zero Point teaching is to explore this nature of consciousness and the human heart, because I believe the next step in human evolution is the awakening of the human heart. And this is what's taught in the different mystical teachings, and attaining the state of self-consciousness. So I think that is what we need throughout humankind. I think in ways there are more and more soulless human beings, and these people need to recover their souls, because all is not lost, but they have to somehow recover their souls. So I think we're in an epic period of time, and I see the battle of humankind. It's also a spiritual battle between forces of truth and righteousness and love, against the forces of evil and domination. And this, in a way, it's a grand cosmic Lord of the Rings story. It's like, wow, it's a pretty heavy story. You look at what's been happened to the human race. The human race got punked. You got punked. The human race became a rat race controlled by a master race. In a way, it's an unspeakably subtle and horrific cosmic tale. And we'll see, hopefully this year, there'll be shifts towards new opportunities to take back our world and reestablish the rule of law in our societies again. Okay, and I'd like to again thank BBS Radio and Don and Doug and Seth who work there and maintain the programs for all that they do, and for having allowed myself and my co-host Jim to have our shows through the past 5 years. And I think we're going into the sixth or seventh, I'm not really sure. Jim, you're there in the background?
Yep.
Yeah, hi Jim, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Chris. I think it'll be, I think I started on the program about maybe 2 months after you began it, and I think that was, I moved to where I live right now in April of 2006, so I think it was probably, I remember the first program I ever did was when I was living at my previous residence, so that had to be in March or early April, and I think you had been on the air, so it'll be 6 years in, I think next month or the month after.
Yeah, that's how I figure it too. Like on my CD that I sell of our BBS shows, mm-hmm. that first year is all the 2006.
Have you ever listened to the whole CD?
Oh no! I mean, it would be hundreds of hours. I mean,
If I had the time,
it would have been so good to have taken notes and had some record of it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have. You know.
Yeah, it's kind of what a long-term ambition of mine would be, to go back and sort of try to edit out. And because I think there are, you know, obviously there are different shows of different quality, but I know that there are some times when just in the programs themselves were so good that you know, and you end up saying in discussion some things that you didn't even know that you knew yourself, or that you fall upon through the act of conversing with one another, something that, you know, is really quite insightful and is a good way of saying things that you're trying to say. And it would be, I wish I had the time to go through and really, revisit the previous episodes. I think probably be surprised by the quality of some of the programs. I just know that there were times where when we got off the air, when we talked later and said, boy, that was really good. And it was really interesting developing this or that idea. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but there's an amazing quantity of material. And, some of it really quite inspired. And it certainly helps to talk about these things and to try to teach about these things because you kind of learn as you go. I've always have it. Like, you never learn as much as when you're teaching.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's
way,
always the thing is that, I remember the first course I taught. Well, actually, the only course I ever taught really at university was when I taught theories of personality when I was a graduate student in psychology. And I thought I knew a reasonable amount about the topic, but then when you have to teach it, you really have to know it. So I think I probably learned more than anybody who was taking the course about it,
Yeah. So I don't know if they've managed to get through to our guest. I'll just ask if is Christopher there? Oh no, okay. So he's not. So okay, I just wanted to check at one point.
I just wanted to say too that thank you to Doug and Don and to BBS for allowing us to be on the air and for their support and for their network. It's been a real pleasure to have this opportunity, and certainly appreciate everything that they've done over the past 6 years for us. It's been great.
Yeah. And Don and Doug, they have such positive attitudes. They're so supportive. They have been. We appreciate them and send our love to them for what they've done. Okay, so,
So you didn't have a show on Christmas Eve?
No, I didn't.
It was funny because I sort of felt badly because we had talked about it, and then I completely got caught up in, as having a party at the week before Christmas, and then Christmas was coming, and I was running around. This thing with my brother had been going on. I was just so distracted, and then I realized, my God, we have a show on Christmas Eve. I'm not going to be able to do it, and so I felt sort of badly about it, but under the circumstances, I guess it's kind of understandable. I was just, I don't know, I was just completely burned out by Christmas. I was just, I slept pretty much during the entire week that I had off. Pretty exhausted.
I didn't have the heart, and if I'm by myself on it, I'll be too radical a bit. And I kind of didn't want to... I've published that book, Jim. You've seen my book, The 1137, and God's Contracting Universe, it's called.
I haven't actually seen it, but I know that you've done it.
And in a way, it was a heavy book for me to get through it. I'm not generally a political person. I never was really interested in politics or activism or anything through my life, My interest is really in science and kind of mysticism and consciousness studies and things like that, the mysteries of the universe, And so, but the 1137 is like this kind of political book and kind of like all about 9/11 and my article on how there weren't any airplanes and the role of the media and staging it. And, it has a section on Gurdjieff's views of the Hasnamasses and the causes of war and human psychopathology. And it has a tribute to Karen. And so it's in a way it was really heavy for me to kind of put. I always have more of an anxiety when I'm kind of writing about that type of material and putting it in a book. And my 0-point proposal for the criminal prosecution of the world elites for their crimes against humanity, where I suggest that we put all these people into jails and take back the wealth of the world and reduce all national debts to zero around the world. And to have that concept of that, I've never heard anyone else espouse it. But to me, it seems it's like a vision of what if justice was reestablished on planet Earth, what that would mean in terms of the debts and poverties of nations. It'd be like everybody's debt would be wiped out. You just wouldn't pay it back to these psychopathic elites. You'd just put them into FEMA camps, and they can have their inoculations and drink aspartame, and we can put smart meters on their units for them, and we can put chips in their hand so the Lord knows who's of the beast, and put them into camps and kind of liberate humankind. So that, having the concept of that, that's kind of what came to me back in 2006. But to kind of put that kind of stuff into paper and put it out there, it's like, is at times very threatening.
I think it kind of misses the point, though. You know, just for a second, let's imagine that happened. What would you think would happen after that? People are people. There would be another group of elites that would arise. That's the way I see it. All these horrible things go on, and people do all these terrible things, but it's kind of like, I don't mean to sound totally cynical, but first of all, it's not going to happen. Secondly, if it did, there's still going to be people involved. It's like I was having this sort of debate with somebody. It wasn't really even a debate, just a comment about, he was talking about, about student debt and about limiting people's incomes and things. I said, on the one hand, you have the extreme capitalists who say, let the market decide, let's not have any restrictions on anything. It's just sort of, social Darwinist, let the invisible hand of the marketplace and everything, which is completely idiotic. And then you have the extreme, socialist vision of equal society where, the government runs everything and people are supposedly equal, but what has history taught us is the only problem that's involved in all of that is human beings are going to be involved. No matter what the system is, there's going to be human beings, and human beings have all sorts of faults, and the biggest fault is that people are asleep, and there's all sorts of degrees of psychopathology existing in human beings of all classes, not just the elites. And as Gurdjieff says, I love that idea of the Hasnamust individual, because I see that as kind of being, that's part of the human collectivist, that there's always going to be these psychopaths who are these power-possessing beings who are going to get themselves in positions where they can exercise these powers and carry out these demonic plans of theirs, and you think who the hell would ever be this depraved or this psychopathic? It's not even just in politics. You see it in science, but you see it in any place. You see it in religion where people have some sort of power. It's very disturbing. I think it's a very useful thing to sort of remind it about. All this is happening, in Gurdjieff terms, is that everything happens, And I always think of whenever I hear anything about war and peace and this is not an argument, by the way, to rationalize the present or to in any way be complacent about the present. I'm not advocating that at all. But what I am saying is that I think you have to be realistic to a certain extent, and not cynically realistic, but more sophisticated, psychologically realistic, that everything happens. And it's that vision that Uspensky describes in In Search of the Miraculous, and when he's walking through a street in St. Petersburg in 1914, I believe, and he goes to the meeting, and he tells the people at the meeting of Gurdjieff's pupils that he had seen these trucks going by, and they were open trucks, and they were loaded with crutches, to the brim with crutches, and several of these trucks rolled by. And he said when he had kind of a resonance with this image as to what it actually meant. And he said, at that point, the world was preparing for war. And he said, in these lorry loads of crutches for legs, which had not yet been blown off, I saw all the cynicism and the fine words and the lies with which people deceive themselves about matters of war and peace. And he said, I instantly thought of the people that would be, you know, would be injured and maimed and killed in all these various cities like Vienna and Paris and St. Petersburg and you know, all these different cities that he said I had visited and I loved so much because they were so different from one another. And yet, you know, this is the reality. And Gurdjieff's reply is, he said, well, what else do you expect? You know, there's no progress. It's like, you know, if one man is unconscious, you know, and is a machine, then 10 men are unconscious are machines, and 1,000 men are unconscious are machines, and 100,000 are a million, you know, and that's another element to the whole psychopathology of the human race, is that everything happens and people can't do, and people do deceive themselves with all these fine words and lies. So you can, it's easy to, even if you're moderately intelligent, to be able to penetrate the lies with which politicians and people rationalize their totally unacceptable actions. I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel, but to turn that kind of attention to yourself and your own life or to people who really do have more noble aspirations and who aren't psychopaths but are human and have these human failings and are unconscious and mechanical to varying degrees, it's very disturbing, but in the same sense, I guess, in a very peculiar way, it's uplifting, because it really, I'm just thinking back to like when we first started studying the fourth way, and I remember, see, at that point, we were both involved in the anti-nuclear movement, like there was quite a threat that, you know, that there was going to be a nuclear war in the late 70s, or it certainly felt that way with the whole end of the Cold War, but we didn't know it was ending. And you know, that I found that perspective very useful, because you realize that, you know, there really aren't good guys or bad guys in any of this. These people are all psychopathic, and all of this is happening, and it's assumed this momentum, which is really out of control, and which may even accidentally blow up the world. Like, it might not even be intentionally done, but it could be intentionally done, because these people are so crazy. And I remember feeling like, you know, how can you explain this other than the fact that people are machines and that people aren't properly conscious? Like, how could a properly conscious human being develop a hydrogen bomb and once they had one, you know, decide that they're going to add 25,000 more, you know? Like, I mean, it's Dr. Strangelove, you know? I mean, it really is. It's just ludicrous. And so in a way, like, I at times I despair of things politically, because you say we live in what seem to be terribly perilous times, and there are so many horrible elements to all this. But at the same time, it's kind of like this is what it is. This is the nightmare aspect of the whole human condition. But I guess at the same time, it's funny, because like for the last month or so, I've kind of had the opposite feeling, because I reread your four articles that you wrote in the Esoteric Quarterly, in which you basically outline the Heart Doctrine and the Zero Point teaching, and I was feeling very uplifted by that, and then I was also studying, going through my notes and trying to summarize some views and books on the near-death experience with Dr. Von Lommel's, which we've talked about on the program lately, and another book which by David Lorimer called Hole in One, which was written in, I think, 1990 or 1991, in which he goes into various elements of the near-death experience. And it's kind of like, it was very uplifting, because in a way, it's as much as we think we know and understand things to a certain extent on this level, like, the world is much more mysterious, and there are things going on which are much, much more complex than our little minds can even possibly begin to imagine. You know, I'm struck by the profundity of this vision that's outlined in your work, and once I kind of began to acquire that schema to understand other things which are truly astounding, like the near-death experience, I'm feeling more hopeful in a peculiar sense, you know, about things. I think that you know, that there's something, behind all this madness, there is some method. You know, I guess that's kind of how I feel it. I'm not used to being optimistic about everything, but I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But be careful about the water.
Be careful about the water.
Well, it's like the old joke, you know, when you're traveling, don't drink the water, you know. It's like,
oh, yeah.
You know, I wouldn't drink the water anywhere right now.
Okay. So I didn't know if that was someone coming in. I may have got another call that kind of, I heard the beep type of thing. Did you hear that?
I didn't.
Okay, so that was probably just on my call. We don't have Christopher in the background, do we? Okay, so I have to. Unfortunately, I had kind of planned on going, had planned a show with Christopher, but we won't have any trouble filling in. I think Gurdjieff's point with Uspensky, or Uspensky's point in Russia in 1914, kind of, is. Everything happens because of the low level of development of the human psyche, and that men are like machines and conditioned by everything, and they don't attain to awakened consciousness. And that's just the way it was. And Gurdjieff, in a way, kind of said that the masses of humankind, they only evolve over like long time periods. But it's, and in a way that like might be over the course of the evolution of the solar system, like huge periods of time, where, as he says, so in a way that can't mean a lot to us. What we have to do is strive towards the psychology of our own evolution, and so that's why the fourth way begins with like work on yourself. That if we don't change ourselves, if humankind doesn't have a shift in consciousness or kind of a deeper understanding of themselves, then things will always be the same, just as you described. And whether or not there could be like a very dramatic kind of shift in human awareness through the planet is hard to say. But that's kind of what I hope and pray for still, that kind of broader awakening. I see Americans, people are under attack in so many ways. Like the countries are under, around the world, people are under attack because their governments owe such huge amounts of money, and to kind of pay those monies to the, you know, IMF and the World Bank and such, it kind of takes all the pension monies of the people of the country, and it sells off their resources, and all the countries around the world, the kind of people are facing that kind of crisis, and there's that, and there's kind of the assault upon people from the chemtrail poisoning that goes on, and the threat of biological agents and vaccines, and now it's all this new information coming out about the dangers of smart meters, which is really very disturbing. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
No.
Have you been aware of that as an issue, Jim? Jim?
No.
No, you hadn't. Okay. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Well, I've heard of it, but I don't really know anything about it. Like, you know, I've.
Yeah, there's the new hydrometers inserted on the sides of homes, and the new ones are digital, and you get a digital reading from it, whereas the old ones used to be analog, and you had the little wheels with numbers on that spun. But the new ones are digital, and what they're doing...
You mean hydrometers?
Yeah, the hydrometers.
Yeah.
They're mandated in Canada. They're mandated on our homes, and they've all been switched over. You know, without people really, I don't believe, understanding the implications of it. But these things are on our home, and they're kind of sending off, radiating. It's mainly, the point is, it adds to the electromagnetic pollution of our home environment. because they're radiating all the time in different frequency ranges, and they can be, have their amplitudes increased. And people are reporting all these kinds of health problems because they're on their home, and they're like stronger than cell phones. Like they're, it's significant kind of microwave radiation being put into the household all the time. And because so the guy, the point of it is, I'm not really sure, the guy who doesn't have to come up to your house to read your meter, but he can read it from the street with a zapper and kind of read these signals. But they're radiating all the time in our house, you know, not just once a month when he comes to read your meter. And they kind of have their surveillance things. And
wait a minute. That's a big jump. What are they radiating?
Well, electromagnetic radiation in certain frequency ranges, okay, that carry the signal about the household electrical use.
But your computer and your television set, any electronic device is on.
You have radiation from it.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's not radiation though. I mean, it's radiating in certain frequencies, but it's not like radiation.
Well, it is radiation. I'm not sure what radiation, unless of nuclear part, like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, electronic devices emit frequencies, right? And that those have been related, like, to extremely low frequencies have been related to certain health problems. But like a meter is, I don't understand how a meter could, like, what would be so dangerous about that.
It depends on the entrainment of the frequency of the meter and the harmonics that might establish with certain other resonator systems, like what would respond to those frequencies in different ranges. According to Dr. Deagle, it interferes the calcium process of cellular metabolism. The frequency range is a particular, well, that's one of the effects. Mm. But the effects that, like in California, there's a movement, people demanding that these be taken off their homes. Mm. And the symptoms of it are dizziness, ringing in the ears, cardiac arrhythmias, nausea, tiredness, different kinds of effects that people are attributing to these meters, including heart attacks and heart arrhythmias, because it interferes with the electromagnetism of the heart. There was one case I heard on the internet radio, this woman who kind of had a whole series of heart problems and had a pacemaker put in, and then it still went on. And then she kind of realized at the end, all these problems arose since she had the smart meters. That some people are more electromagnetically sensitive. So there's a whole, you know, this was mandated in the States at the cost of $4 billion that everybody have a smart meter. But it's kind of creating this kind of colossal electromagnetic pollution. You know, it's like have you ever seen those pictures on YouTube where people put four cell phones?
Yeah, apparently that's phony. Where they pop the popcorn.
Yeah,
apparently that's phony. It's hilarious. I mean, apparently I've been told that's bullshit.
Serious.
Yeah, no, I thought it was amazing when I saw it because I'm very distrustful of cell phones. I mean, it's like, yeah, I guess I don't really know.
Type of principle anyway.
Well,
it's
kind of like, you know, can this actually be worse than holding a cell phone up to your ear for 12 hours a day like some people do, or, you know, living under power lines? Because, you know, like
same class.
Well, but, like, I mean, I would think that it would be much more dangerous to live under power lines than to have a meter, which the thing that sits on the side of your house. Like, because, you know, like, the research on power lines is very, I mean, you get both opinions, eh? Because people swear up and down that, oh, no, that it's not dangerous, and other people swear up and down, oh, yeah, it is dangerous, and, you know, there's all sorts of, I mean, it seems like the. I'm just sort of what I know of this, and which is not very much. I'll preface it by that, but it seems like certain people are more sensitive to these things and others aren't. So maybe, like in aggregate statistics, things don't appear to be dangerous that are actually very dangerous to certain individuals. I mean, that's sort of my own take, because I don't really understand, you know, as I say, I've read a fair amount of research about that, and it doesn't seem like it's clear-cut one way or the other to me, but it does seem that definitely certain individuals do suffer ill effects, like health effects and psychological effects from being close to power lines, you know. But
yeah, and some people are very much more sensitive. Like I know Karen
could
not even be in the same room almost as a television. She hated them.
Yeah.
And when we had a television, whenever it wasn't on, it was unplugged and covered over.
But she would sit and watch her computer for hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? But then at times she felt she was being fried by her computer.
Well, I was going to say, like, what's the difference? It's like, you know,
well,
like,
it's
basically
a similar path.
Yeah, it's the same thing, really. It's, I mean,
of
it's
electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
And the, I mean,
it's
it is an unknown area, largely unknown. Like, you know, it's not well enough researched.
Well, I mean, you want to get more complex than that. It's like nobody really understands what the effects of living in these huge electric grids, you know, we live in electric societies, you know, like where cities have these huge power grids, and you're living in the middle of that with all of these things, and all of these, I mean, you know. I mean,
running everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time. And,
yeah.
And you know, I know that my brother, who lived in a place with no running water and no electricity for 6 years and was exposed to no electricity for
mm-hmm.
6 years, basically said, if you want to have an experiment in changing your consciousness, go and live, you know, in a place like that for 6 years. He said you definitely become much more sensitive to all sorts of things, natural things, but also it does change you. It changes you quite dramatically. I mean, I often wonder of that about cancers, like, you know, to what extent, even like, because nobody really definitively has done any research on this, I don't think.
On which?
On what the effects of living in these cities with these huge electrical grids, you know, like, I mean,
yeah.
be exposed to this. Like, I
yeah.
mean, you have to compare it to places where there was no electricity, you know. I mean, it would be
yeah.
very hard to do, like, really comprehensive, smart, long-term studies on that.
Yeah, it would be immensely or even impossible, because you can't really find places without those radiations.
Very few.
Like,
fewer and fewer.
Mean, you think of it, like, if I had a cellular phone in my hand, anyone who had a cellular phone, you turn it on and you can receive a signal. And that signal, like, you can receive that signal no matter where you are. So your signal is really, like, going everywhere. So everybody's signal is going everywhere all the time, kind of. Like, obviously, like, it's like space. Like, you look at space and it seems empty, but inside that
yeah.
space is like everybody's telephone signals and all these radiations, you know, propagated from your neighbor using their sewing machine. You know, all the there's so many simultaneous radiations present within space itself, all simultaneously present. So I guess what's important is the kind of frequency ranges and how that interacts with different parts of the body, I think, is an important aspect to it. And it is an area which needs to be studied more. That's the problem, is that these inventions are introduced and they're sponsored and promoted by the multinational corporations that have most to benefit from the technologies. And then I think that, they put into effect, and then there's kind of a suppression of concerns around health issues. It's just like, what's the effect of having, is it called Wi-Fi, or what is it called? Wi-Fi, like, available. So
that means
you're anywhere. So everybody's internet stuff is passing through us all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's funny, because I was just telling somebody today, like, you know, I mean, like, take an example, like electric light. I was telling him about John Ott's work, you know, and about the fact that we're exposed all the time to this light which doesn't provide full spectrum, and then the introduction of fluorescent light and the peaking in the pink range of the fluorescent light and all of the ill effects that have been attributed to, you know, not getting full spectrum light, you know. So I mean that's another thing that, like, you know, was introduced, and it seemed like a really progressive and great thing, and in many ways it is, obviously, to have light, you know, it changed things dramatically. But with every, there's always a risk, and that's the thing, is that products are just, you know, introduced willy-nilly without much real research and not much thought as to what, you know, I mean, well, aerosol cans, you know. One small problem with them was that they were destroying the ozone layer. Other than that, they were great.
Yeah, it's funny how I don't know what we hear. I haven't heard as much about the ozone layer. One time that was such a huge, monstrous threat to us. And
well,
one doesn't hear about that very much anymore. I haven't.
I heard something recently that, you know, with the banning the CFCs, there was like a real good response into that. But now that there's another problem with something else related to, I forget what it was about, and it's like, oh, God, you know, it's like more, I think it's this wasn't actually related to the ozone layer. It was more that the refrigeration, that the technology that they've introduced to replace chlorofluorocarbons has created more problems in terms of global warming. So it's like, you know, for every thing that we do, it seems that we're sort of futilely, you know, trying to readjust to things. It's like, oddly enough, I was just reading about Tesla and his work and this guy had written an appreciation of it, and he had long thought that that the Earth's energy could be accessed, that the standing wave of the Earth itself, it could be accessed, and that could provide, you know, truly clean renewable energy. And that was his kind of his grand vision, was that he was, you know, it's going to be able to develop that, but
energy.
Yeah, you have to think that at some level, at some time, somebody, you know, is going to figure out something that really is, you know, non-invasive and to be able to tap into that. But of course, you know, at this point, if somebody was to discover that, I'm sure there'd be all sorts of movement afoot to suppress it, because it was...
Well, that's what's said of Tesla. What I understood as part of the story is that J.P. Morgan said, well, can you put a meter on it?
Yeah.
But he said no.
Yeah.
And they destroyed Tesla's labs or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a lot... I mean, I don't know Tesla's story or kind of inventions and such, but that's kind of what... He seemed at one point his labs were destroyed and
yeah, well, he had, my understanding was that he was destroyed more by Thomas Edison than by anybody. But, you know, he had worked in Edison's lab, and Edison recognized him as a genius to rival his own, and was at war with them to a certain extent. I don't really know the story about the destruction of his labs. It was like, you know, very odd.
Yeah, that's mentioned in that movie, Thrive. Did you watch that?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah, because I do want to come back to that. We have a different guest next week. So in 2 weeks, in two shows from now, I did want to go through that movie. It's very interesting. And it has material on Tesla and free energy technologies and that.
Very interesting. Yeah.
And it kind of shows, like, what it shows is that there were these different people with these different inventions, and they all kind of ended up seeming to be depressed. You know, like some people say there are cold fusion generators. In fact, I've heard that Home Depot apparently has a patent or the rights to sell a Japanese one or something.
Yeah. Well, a friend of Doug and Laura's was working on cold fusion. About 15, 20 years ago, and thought that it looked very promising. He's a systems engineer who had an interest in this, and yeah.
And then there was, like that fellow Stan Myers who had that water car.
Oh, yeah.
In California.
Yeah.
Like, that was unbelievable. Like, I've seen video tubes of it functioning. Like, you know, he had some way of using water as a gasoline, you know,
yeah,
as a power source.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see a whole new era kind of emerging. Some of these inventions, if they ever came forward, would have revolutionary effects on our society.
Have you ever seen that movie on Who Killed the Electric Car?
I think I've watched some of it.
I've never seen the movie yet, but I've seen an excerpt from it. It was very, very interesting. And it reminds me of the guy that we had on the program who has the book on suppressed inventions, Robert, is it Eisen? Is that his name?
Oh, yeah, Eisen, John Eisen from New Zealand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting book, actually. It's a lot of very interesting material in his work.
Yeah, you'd enjoy the movie Thrive, because it's similar. They give a whole thing on different free energy technologies that were suppressed, and then they go into cancer cures and health cures and other, you know, things being suppressed in that field, you know. And then the movie evolves wholly into this kind of, well, what's underlying this? Why are all these things being expressed? And it kind of gets into the whole underlying structures of the kind of banksters and kind of the system that's being brought in around the world, you know. It's an interesting movie like that. Okay, I heard another kind of beat.
I heard that.
Did you hear that, or did we have someone join us?
I don't know.
No, I guess we didn't. Okay. I was still hoping our guest was going to arrive. I'm not really sure what happened with that. Okay, so, so watch for smart meters. They're being called murder meters. Yeah. And interesting concern about that. It's like another. I love the term Gurdjieff uses in Beelzebub's Tales. He talks about Husnamussian science. It's like the science of Husnamusses, you know? It's where, like, science is used for all these kind of psychopathic ends, and, you know, like, all the money's put into creating all these terrible weapons of all these kinds, eh?
But is anybody people aren't really suggesting that this has been done intentionally, but rather it's a side effect that they didn't understand, or is they,
They believe that it's part of the genocidal plans.
I have a very difficult time believing that.
You still don't accept that.
No,
I've talked about that before.
I think it's completely ridiculous. Actually, like, the evidence is rather the contrary. I say, you know, people are killing you all the time with, you know, like, giving you what you want in terms of products. You know, like, I mean, the environment is so polluted by all of these things that people develop and people buy them. And, you know, what the bottom line is that people are living longer. The Earth's population isn't shrinking; it's growing, and it's growing quite radically. You know, it's like, I don't think there's any evidence for that. I find that bizarre. I just do not get that idea whatsoever, you know. I mean, there are all sorts of horrible things being done to people, but, you know, that's not one of them in my mind.
There is also all kinds of documentation of the viewpoints of people who do feel that overpopulation is the world's major problem, and how that is widely regarded among the world elites is overpopulation.
Well, I regard
it as a major problem. It's on the Georgia Guidestones, you know.
I regard it as a major problem. It is a major problem. It's like,
well,
population, but it's, you know, that's why I say I don't buy the idea that people are, that there's a genocidal program. There's an easy way to kill people. Just start a war, you know. Like, I mean,
not a good way. I mean,
well, it's not. It's a very effective way. It's like, if you look at the figures, it's a very effective way to kill people. But I mean, you can make the argument too that, you know, there are all sorts of natural ways with the increase in population that the encroachment on all sorts of territories throughout the world of the growing population have completely exposed people to all sorts of things that can be deadly in terms of health problems. And you know, perfectly natural explanation, which is directly related to population growth. I mean, urbanization itself is a major, major health issue because there's too many people concentrated in too small a space. Like, you know, Mexico City, 50 yeah. million people. You
I
can't
know,
breathe,
unbelievable.
You can't breathe the air. Delhi,
how many
you know.
People in Mexico?
50 million.
Holy smokes, more than in the whole country of Canada.
Yeah. I don't know if it's 50, it's at least 40, but I think it's
28. But
oh no, it's over 40, and the air is unbreathable there anyways because of the natural setting of it. You know, Toronto, one of the world's most polluted cities. You know, it's Toronto, air pollution here, but you're not allowed to smoke in bars.
yeah, I can. I can feel it just driving into Toronto.
Oh, you can see it 60 miles away when you're driving from up north and you're looking down at Toronto. You can see the air pollution. Like, I mean, it's entirely visible. You know, and it, in the summertime, it just hangs. Like, you know, smog is incredible here. So I don't know. It's like I say, there are lots of ways of making people sick and lots of ways of killing them, you know. Like, I mean, there's no shortage of, that's one thing that we have in abundance, you know. It's like there are many ways to die and many ways to make people very, very ill. Some of them intentional and many of them unintentional, you know. It's just like, as I say, population growth itself is a health hazard. Like, that's very clear, you know. But, you know, big questions, like, very big questions.
Yeah, they're big questions. I don't trust their population estimates and such, and I'm not sure people are living longer. I'm not sure.
Because I
see us as depending on population statistics. We depend on the same people who would be claimed to be the ones who want to reduce the population.
Well, but you can make that argument about anything. You can get into it. Like, I mean, like, I just don't agree that it's all. I mean, people do live longer. There are more people. I mean, you just have to kind of look around. I mean, it's like all sorts of people are living to be 100 now. I mean, it's in the West, you know. It's like they just do. I just don't think these things are all made up, you know. I don't buy that whatsoever. It's just like, you know.
Yeah.
I just think, like, you know, your evidentiary standards, you know, it's like, your evidentiary standards are, you have to trust somebody on something. And it's like, you know, I don't trust most of the stuff that I read on the internet because a lot of it is just complete made up BS that to me, like, you know, like there's no evidence for it other than somebody saying something. I can go on the internet and make anything up. I can make up a much better story than some of the things I've read about the supposed genocide. And I mean, I've been on some of these sites where they're talking about like the attempts to reduce the world's population, and it struck me as being completely bizarre and idiotic, actually. That was my impression of it. It's just like, where are these people getting this from? So, I mean, like I say, I could go on there and make up a better story than that. You know, I mean,
funny. I don't see how you don't see it, because to me, it's all over, and there's all kinds of evidences and all kinds
of examples. Where is the evidence for it? What is the evidence that, what are we talking about, first of all?
Well, different things. I mean, I would say, for instance, that the global elites intentionally spread illness through the inoculation programs.
Well,
that's one example, okay? And because they give people illnesses and then they prescribe medications for those people with illnesses. And I believe that inoculation programs has been a fraud from the beginning, and the main cause of cancer, ADHD, autism, all kinds of different syndromes, because different people have different weaknesses, like system specificity, kind of.
Well,
in their response to substances.
Just in response to that, like there is no inoculation for malaria. Malaria still kills more people than any disease in the world. I'm not a huge fan of vaccines in general, but because I think the evidence on even on their effectiveness is somewhat equivocal. But when I was a kid, if you didn't get inoculated for polio, you got polio.
Well, I think that was a fraud, too. I don't think that's the case. I think that was part of their propaganda. And because the statistics on it, which I've seen, show that the
Wait a minute. What statistics? Where are you getting these statistics from? See, like, you can play this game both ways. I dispute your source. You know, I don't even know what it is, but I dispute it. Like, you know, like, I mean,
don't want to know what it is.
I'm being facetious. It's like you saying, well, I dispute, like, these figures about the world's population. What figures? Like, I mean,
thinking the most recent one is where they declared Halloween to be the day on which the world reached 7 billion. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
The UN did.
Yeah.
And well, that's my source.
Have you gone door to door to count the number of people in the world?
Well, no.
How can you dispute it? I mean, but it's like it's self fulfilling prophecy. It's like you're arguing that you don't believe it, so you don't trust it because you don't believe it. Like, I mean, you have no, like, that's what I'm saying. I could just arbitrarily say, I don't agree with your figures. I don't even know what they are. Like, I mean, even before I hear them, I'm just going to dismiss them. Like, I mean,
the reason for that is that, like, some people call the World Health Organization, they call it the World Homicidal Organization. And the belief is that after the Second World War, they brought a lot of the Nazi doctors over who went into the UN. And that there is a segment in the UN which have these kind of eugenicist plans, and population reduction is part of it. The World Health Organization is accused of infecting 400,000 African women with AIDS through a vaccination.
By who? Yeah, I mean, but the same people will say that, you know, like, that... They'll criticize, you know, Bill Gates and like the lady you had on before is talking about Bill Gates, but Bill Gates gives money to fight AIDS in Africa, and somehow it's like that's part of the plan.
It's presented as noble to save these people, but really what they do is they cause infertility and spread illness.
Why don't they just let them die? That would work.
Well, they would be healthy.
That would definitely work. Just let the AIDS keep ravaging people. It is. You do accept.
But they created AIDS in the first place.
Who's they? Do you have?
You have to go into the books on the investigation who've investigated AIDS phenomena.
What people? Again, it's like, you know, you're being very selective about this. Like, I've read about the origins of AIDS. There's all sorts of theories about the origins of AIDS, and nobody really knows. Like, I mean,
some people do likely know.
That's where I just
you can't say nobody knows. There was a truth to some reality. It's not reality.
Well, no, that's not necessarily true. It may well be that. I mean, quite logically, let's just think about this for a second. Quite logically.
Oh yeah, well, you're right.
It may be. You don't know that. I mean, I'm not even disputing that they may be right. I'm just saying I don't think that you really know that. It's like the most important thing to know is what you know and what you don't know. And like a lot of these things, it's like you don't know that. You just don't. You know, you may have your ideas, you may have your suspicions, but you don't know it. And it's very dangerous to me. Like I'm not even disputing that this could be true. I'm just not willing to believe because somebody puts it on the internet that, oh, this is true. Like, the internet is filled with crazy people. Like, that's my observation anyway. See that. Like, you know, if you see that in the elites, I see that in the internet. It's like I see a lot of people on the internet. They just post things. It's complete bullshit. You know, I just don't get it. And it's like you have to be, well... That's just another argument for another day, but it's like I just don't buy all this that people are out to consciously murder the world's population. It's like I just don't get that. I don't agree with it. I think it's
completely... Well, that's okay. We can have different viewpoints. I mean, my viewpoint is that there is a group, and yours is that there isn't, and you argue it really well, and you raise good points. We don't have to. You know, we don't have to agree on what our views are.
No,
but mine definitely is that there is a group, and I wish that were not true. I hope it's not true.
Yeah, no,
but,
well,
but,
I hope
but
it
as
isn't.
I read the evidence that I've been exposed to, that's what I come to, is that it is true.
Hmm.
I mean, I see it. I see it. It's just seeing, reading the different copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and kind of seeing how there's people with that kind of attitude.
But you don't even know. You don't even know the story of that. We've talked about this before. You know
that's
one of the great.
About it.
You know that's one of the great forgeries, eh? And it's brought up.
A forgery. What was it a forgery of?
It was to discredit the Jews. I mean, there's a whole, you should read about
but,
it. Like,
but have you ever read them?
Yeah, but it's made up.
It's not written to discredit the Jews. It's written from a Jewish perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But
okay.
It's not. But it wasn't written. It was written. It was written in Russia by people who were anti-Semitic. That's the
or,
whole point.
Or that's what the propaganda was. To deceive people about its origin. I mean, I know these. There are two texts which people say it's drawn from these two texts.
But
I would say that was the misinformation to try to invalidate it as.
Well, I would say
but in a way,
at the end of the day, are we led to the conclusion that the Jews are behind this world war domination conspiracy? Because I mean, like, please, you know,
why
I don't even want
put
to talk
it in
about
those
that.
Terms
like,
exactly.
Well, I would, you know, like cause
well,
that's
not what it's saying.
Well, but
I
as
don't
they
think
say,
it's
like.
Saying, Jews are like all Jews are part of it. I don't think
that's pretty much what it was used to. Has been used to leads to. Like I mean that's the
I
whole
don't
point.
See it
you
as
should...
leading to that. It's just like you take someone like the work of Henry Mackow, and he's Jewish, and he's kind
yeah,
of
and
like
he's nuts.
Well, I don't
like,
see him
well,
as nuts
he,
at all. I think he's
he
a very profound researcher.
I think he's a very profound nut. but as I say, I was like you know. I mean, you can't argue with it. Like, I mean, you just can't, you know. Like, I mean, you can believe what you want to believe. I just don't believe any of this. I really don't. And I'm, as I say, I find it galling that anybody even wants to talk about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That just annoys me because it's, like, so stupid, you know. It just is.
Well, but if you read them, whether or not
read about them. That's all I'm suggesting. Like, do some research about that.
I have. I've read a dozen things on them. That's why I don't believe the line that they were a forgery. Because a forgery of what? And I haven't seen this other source that they were really in this other source. I don't believe they were in these plays about Montesquieu and someone else. I think that was the cover-up of them. But in a way, it's irrespective of their origin. What's so amazing about it is it's what has been done. In a way, it so describes the system of kind of world government that's really in place now, I would say. But there again, we differ on that because you don't see there as being an organized kind of international criminal cabal. Whereas I do, I see it as like this whole network of all these different secret societies and interrelated secret societies, which has a structure to it. So, again, we differ on that. And, you know, I think we both want the truth. But at this time, we have different viewpoints of what that is, and that's fine. Jim?
Yep.
Okay. So anyway, okay, I didn't mean to get off on that. I'm not sure how we got off onto that. Why don't we try to bring it back to what we'll bring it back to? We kind of started talking about the awakening. I mean, I let's find what we agree on. I think what we agree on is that people, we human beings, to make things differently, to make a new world, there has to be an awakening of humankind. And whether that can occur on a mass level or whether that just occurs individually, it makes sense that it can occur individually. whether or not society could undergo such a kind of massive shift of consciousness is definitely a moot point.
Yeah, see,
I don't think we see signs of it at all. I think we see the opposite. It's like Gurdjieff says, modern society kind of demands people be more and more robotic, kind of. And it's like the mass society, that's what it's becoming in a way.
That's what I was trying to get to earlier when I was saying about that, you know, we have to talk about the psychopathology of
yeah.
humankind and of the normal waking consciousness. And in a way, like, not to belabor this, but I sort of see that, like, to me, that's like a lot of these theories are just, to me, they're just further evidence of the psychopathology of normal people. Like, I mean, the elites have their psychopathology, and then other people have their psychopathology. But to get to the point, like, I think that this is a very important point, and this is something I don't agree with that I see in a lot of discussions of consciousness. When people talk about that consciousness is shifting and the mass of humanity, there's going to be an awakening or a realization of a transition to a higher state. Like, Gurdjieff's very clear about that, that that's not possible, that it just takes place in such a long time scale that really the only possible evolution of consciousness is at the individual level, and that individuals can evolve, but the time frame for humanity as a whole is very different. And I mean, obviously, I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that it is probably true that, and that's it. Like, I find it odd, a lot of people who talk about, you know, changing consciousness, they don't make that distinction. Like, they seem to think that, you know, if there are new ideas out there and people are headed in a certain direction, there's going to be this huge transformation. And I'm quite skeptical that that actually is going to take place. Like,
Gurdjieff says, also,
although it might, you know, I mean, I'm quite willing to admit I could be completely wrong about that because I don't really know. So,
yeah. Yeah. But it's also like Gurdjieff says, consciousness can't evolve unconsciously.
Yeah.
Like, it can't happen. Like,
yeah,
for
exactly.
Gurdjieff,
that's why it's logical.
It won't just happen because it's something that's against the whole mechanical flow of life. Even though he does leave the possibility open in ways because of the role he ascribes to shocks in his
right.
system. Like, he talks, when Gurdjieff explains things in terms of octave or the law of seven, how there's seven levels to any process, and the eighth is the completion of the octave. And he talks about how humankind is like men number one, two, and three. So we sound the do, re, mi of our cosmic octave. But very few people get further to get to become men number four, five, six, or seven. So, but what carries a person from the lower three levels could help them get from the do, re, mi to the fa is what he describes as a shock, which is something from outside of the system. And it could be cataclysmic events, perhaps. You know, sometimes Gurdjieff talks about major traumas as being shocks. I think the system allows for the possibility of kind of sudden transformation on the broader level. And it's also interesting in Beelzebub's tales, and this is the one thing I haven't yet put in that book, but he does describe a process where he says there's this, you know, you've heard of this talk about the comet Elohim or something.
Elohim, yeah.
Yeah, Elohim, and then other people, there's another sun, all these things that are propagated like Basilia. But anyway, Gurdjieff refers to that type of process where he says there's this kind of comet that kind of transverses our path and does cause this kind of eruption at certain periods. And he says that that can be channeled into kind of an awakening process. He has a whole name for it in Beelzebub's Tales. This is one thing I didn't put into my last version of the book, which I had wanted to get into. So it was funny because the talk of the comets and people who kind of hypothesize these kind of disruptions of the solar system, I saw an element of Gurdjieff having a similar view in the tales. I'll track that out and bring that up next show and read the paragraph he has on it. Yeah. But generally, I think our point is that unless there's a change in human beings, some shift of consciousness, then everything will go on in the same way, and the rich get richer, and the poor get poorer, and people find ever new inventions for mass murdering each other, and we have this kind of strange psyche of the three-brained beings on the planet Earth. Gurdjieff certainly uses some appropriate terms in his book to describe the kind of state of humanity and how they have such a false consciousness system.
Here's I was just looking, actually, because I wanted to talk about something about, you know, the difference between the individual and humanity as a whole. And he, Gurdjieff, this is, I think, from In Search of the Miraculous. This is a talk he's giving to his pupils. He said, "Humanity neither progresses nor evolves. What seems to us to be progress or evolution is a partial modification, which can be immediately counterbalanced by a corresponding modification in an opposite direction. Humanity, like the rest of organic life, exists on Earth for the needs and the purposes of the Earth, and it is exactly as it should be for the Earth's requirements at the present time. Only a thought as theoretical and as far removed from fact as modern European thought could have conceived the evolution of man to be possible apart from surrounding nature, or have regarded the evolution of man as a gradual conquest of nature. This is quite impossible. In living, in dying, in evolving, in degenerating, man equally serves the purposes of nature, or rather nature makes equal use through purpose, makes equal use, though perhaps for different purposes, of the products of both evolution and degeneration. And at the same time, humanity as a whole can never escape from nature, for even in struggling against nature, man acts in conformity with her purposes. The evolution of large masses of humanity is opposed to nature's purposes. The evolution of a certain small percentage may be in accord with nature's purposes. Man contains within him the possibility of evolution, but the evolution of humanity as a whole, that is, the development of these possibilities in all men or in most of them, or even a large number of them, is not necessary for the purposes of the Earth or the planetary world in general, and it might in fact be injurious or fatal. There exists, therefore, special forces of a planetary character which opposes the evolution of large masses of humanity and keep it at the level that it ought to be." So that's a very, it's funny because he embeds human beings within the Earth's purposes and then the Earth within the cosmic purpose and says that humanity, like he says at one point, like in human beings, like a cell in the body, like whether or not it evolves or devolves, degenerates, decays, dies, doesn't really matter. It's not going to make any great impact on things. And that's the sort of the degree of freedom that the human has in terms of evolving. Like the individual person can evolve, but the large masses of people or even a large number of people can't evolve, and that evolution is taking place on the Earth, but in a very, very different time scale from that of an individual, a time scale which essentially makes it invisible to us, like we couldn't realize it. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because, as I say, like people talk about, well, you know, we're entering this epic. I mean, we have this whole thing about 2012, which might, you know, be the end of this period according to the Mayan calendar. And it's like, and you know, I mean, we have to kind of qualify these things is that it may well be true, but that there's something happening, but it may well be that we're not even going to be aware of it, but that it's happening on another dimensional level, which we're not even, you know, aware or cognizant of. There's that. And then at one point, Gurdjieff talks about, like in the evolution of humanity, is that it comes to a certain crossroads, like shock points in octaves, where a certain thing has to happen for humanity to continue to evolve, or that the octave will be deflected and humanity will degenerate. And at one point he says it's impossible to speculate about these moments, like to know for sure. Like, you know, we might think that we might know, but we can't. And I remember thinking very clearly, like when I was writing about this, as I say, it was the late 1970s, and it seemed like, you know, that the arms race was continuing, and it really seemed like there might be the possibility of a nuclear war. And, you know, I thought at the time, like, this could well be, like, this period, you know, like this crossroads for humanity, because, like, if we end up destroying ourselves, obviously, you know, if there's a nuclear war, it's going to change the course of human evolution rather drastically. And but then at the same time, like, you think, well, maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it was the outbreak of the First World War, the first real mechanized war on a huge scale, or maybe it was the 1760s and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, which completely changed, you know, humanity on the face of the earth in so many different ways. Like, I mean, you know, you can play that game in different ways. Like, there are all these different periods, like, where you think, well, this could be like this critical development. I mean, maybe it was the invention of the integrated circuit or the transistor, you know, which created this whole revolution in technology and put us into the information age. Like, who knows? Like, I mean, we don't know. I guess that's the point. But what I'm saying is that there are periods, there are points in history, according to Gurdjieff, where humanity does reach certain points, like a crossroads where it can either continue to evolve, or it can, you know, something doesn't happen or something does happen, which either deflects or allows the octave to continue to progress.
Yeah.
So, like, it's hard to tell where we are. Like, it would be very easy to argue that we're degenerating, you know. But it would
I would have thought from the Gurdjieff perspective, one would argue that. Like, I think Gurdjieff said that, like, how he says modern society it demands robots and people are becoming more and more mechanical.
Yeah,
and they're getting away from their essence values. That's why he saw people who lived in, like, maybe closer to nature or in third world countries sometimes are closer to their essence.
Yeah.
Whereas modern civilization, and I think especially with the information age in ways in the media and such.
But at the same time, like, to counter that, I mean, he was also very enthusiastic about technology, and that he said, you know, that there were great possibilities in this. So it was kind of like take the knowledge of the West and the understanding of the East. I think what he thought was that there had been a real loss of something essential, like you say, in people, and that they were living these artificial lives which were becoming more and more mechanical. And I mean, God, if he was alive today, I think he'd have something very interesting to say, I'm sure, about, like, our current, you know, like, Western civilization, quote-unquote, is so kind of frivolous and so devoid of essential values, and so wrapped up in the cult of personality and all the worst senses of the word, that, you know.
It's amazing reading Beelzebub's tales, like how Gurdjieff saw exactly what it's like today, but he saw that back in the 1920s.
Yeah.
He saw, like, it's amazing reading
his book. I was struck by that, too. I was like, wow.
I remember one quote from Gurdjieff where he talks about, like, the more absolutely absurd and ridiculous someone will act, then the more kind of esteem and recognition that they'll become known. And you see that, like, in Hollywood, like, the more outrageously ridiculous, like, Lady Gaga type things.
Yeah.
And the more most absurd thing you can do, and then you know that you're the, you know, no one can say anything wrong about you, and you're the, you know, newest invention. And it's so funny, and it's so true what he saw, the kind of falsity. But I want to go back to a couple things you said and that I had points on when we're talking about, like, the evolution of humanity versus the evolution of the individual. And one thing Gurdjieff says that's really interesting, he kind of sees life on Earth as an experiment of the sun, in a way, or an experiment of levels of intelligence. And so, like, for Gurdjieff, there's not, like, this inevitability of evolution. It could be that humankind degenerates and doesn't fulfill its cosmic purposes. So as a race, like, there can be a failure. You know, humankind didn't evolve. They wiped themselves out. You know, they made themselves extinct somehow. And a second point was, he has a very profound idea. He says that there are two principles by which someone can live and die. And one of these principles is, he says, they die like a dog, because they don't acquire anything in their soul nature. And when they die like dog. They don't have any, they don't retain anything in their soul life. So in a way, they become fertilizer. They go back into the earth and feed the possibility of future growth. But they die like a dog, whereas according, supposedly, like what's supposed to happen is that human beings are able to attain these higher being bodies and evolve in terms of the life of the soul. And then they say they can serve higher cosmic purposes instead of only feeding the earth and the moon. And he talks, sometimes he talks, the end of the tales, he has that notion of the stream that goes into two currents. And some people follow one current, and that, you know, that could be the masses of humankind who die like dogs because they don't put up anything for their soul life. And then those others, beings who can escape that stream because they've gained something in terms of their own accumulation of finer matters and the development of their higher being bodies. So they've attained something. Like Gurdjieff says, at death you can kind of feed the moon, or you could attain to the sun. And so some people would, he says, anytime any organic life form dies, like any dog, it feeds the moon. A certain energy passes to the moon. Whereas Gurdjieff's saying, you know, the individual can attain to the level of the sun, which would be more analogous to attaining into a heaven world or a higher dimensional reality. So it's interesting, the notion of there being two streams. And you know, you can't speak of humanity as a whole because there are these two streams occurring at the same time.
Yeah.
Those are just associations when you're
reading. Yeah, no, I think it's really good.
It ties into this issue that what we're trying to address is like the difference between the evolution of individuals versus like how feasible is it that humankind as a whole might make an evolutionary step in the awakening of consciousness, tends to be against the Gurdjieff work.
Yeah, one thing that Gurdjieff says about the masses as a whole of humanity is that he says that it's the same on the level of humanity is the same with an individual. It starts with a nucleus of consciousness and then it grows. And so he said like a number of individuals become conscious, like a group of cells, and then they become more and more evolved, and they proliferate and become more and more, you know, advanced and developed and more influential on the organism as a whole. And I think like that's something to remember too, is that, you know, it's not just that an individual can escape or an individual can become evolved, but the individual with other individuals is creating more of a conscious nucleus, which is influencing the entirety of humanity. Mm-hmm. Like it's.
And in the tales, that's a really good point. Like in the Beelzebub's tales, he describes that as having happened after the sacred individual Ashiashimash, who was supposed to have kind of spread a genuine. He's described as a sacred messenger from above.
From above,
and he came back he incarnated, and he. Gurdjieff says that human beings were so degenerate that they couldn't attain evolution through faith, hope, and love, like the traditional higher sacred being impulses, he calls them, faith, hope, and love. But there was still the remorse of conscience, which could function as a route to kind of higher attainment, and that Ashiashimash had done kind of what you were describing, Jim, in terms of nucleus of people who had made attainments, and then they went out and they formed groups around them. And it had actually brought about a period of
peace.
Like the lack of warfare
and
conflict between nations, and a period of abundance. And, And then Beelzebub was interested, like, what happened that led to the destruction of the accomplishments of Ashiash Shimash. And he talks about that in the tales. So like you described, like Gurdjieff kind of described that as occurring, and there being this period of prosperity and diminution of war and such. In history, he gives an example of that.
When you were talking earlier about humanity as being like an experiment of the sun, it isn't like Ashiatish. I've been looking for this. I know I read somewhere that the derivation of that name is like, it's like a solar incarnation, right? Like he's like a being of the sun, because it's like it's related to the Zoroastrian tradition, and the god of light in Zoroastrianism is Ahura, I think Ahura, I can never remember that name, Mazda maybe, but it's related somehow to that Zoroastrian tradition and the idea of Ashiatish Shimash as being a solar divinity, like who's come from the sun. Just in overview of the whole everything we talked about in the program, I often think about, like, you know, the times we're in and you know, how to kind of regard all of this, you know. And as they say, like, to me, like, to a certain extent, is like, yeah, I can kind of, you know, I'm obviously concerned. I'm more concerned for the people that come after me than I am for myself. I'm getting old. I'm going to die. Like, I'm not going to be around to see the worst of this. I'm actually much more disturbed about the future than I am about the present, and it's pretty bad. But having said that, you know, it's like, you know, I think there's much more going on than I can grasp, and my consciousness, my intelligence is limited, so I don't really know what's going on, and I freely admit that. But I always think of, like, in Henry Miller's writings, and especially his essay Murder the Murderer, which is written at the beginning and the second and the end of the Second World War, which is written in a form of an open letter to a friend of his who was a private in the French army. And Miller was an anarchist in the sense that he wasn't like a bomb-throwing anarchist, but an anarchist in the sense that he just didn't believe in the state, and he didn't believe in dying for the state. And he always had this thing about, you know, in one of his essays he says, you know, whatever time people are living in, they always think it's the worst of times, and that, you know, that there's terribly perilous times and everything. But this is really amazing, because this was written like in 1945, and he says, a period of darkness has set in. The world seems determined to resolve its problems by force. No single individual can stem the tide of hate. We are in the grip of cosmic forces, and each one does what he can or must. To each man, the conflict assumes a different face. Millions of men and women will sacrifice their lives. Millions more will be maimed and mutilated. The innocent will suffer with the guilty, the wise with the foolish. It is beyond control now. We are in the hands of fate. Useless to say now that it need not have happened. It is not for us to question what happens. It is for us to accept. But there are thousands of ways of accepting the inevitable. In the way we accept lies our ability to transform a situation. No disaster is irremediable. The whole meaning of life is contained in the word suffering. I love that line. The whole meaning of life is contained in the word suffering. That all the world can be suffering at one time is a fact of tremendous significance. It never has happened before. It is an opportunity which we can reject or use to advantage. And I think, like, in what he's talking about there, when he's saying that, you know, that you can transform the meaning of things, I mean, I think that's the true teaching of esotericism, is the meaning of everything can, you know, things, horrible things can happen, but it's like the degree of consciousness of suffering does transform things. And in a way, like, with sort of like the growing global consciousness, in the sense that we are linked through information, and I mean it specifically in that sense of the use of the word consciousness, like, there's an awareness of ourselves as human beings that has never existed before. Like, we are in a different time. Like, it's clear that we're in a different time. And so, like, in a way, things are terrible, but in a way, there's this germ of this possibility. Like, I mean, this is, I think, what you keep talking about, is like that people will awaken, and it's like But in a way, it's like to suffer it too. Like it's to be to consciously suffer it, and not to suffer it like, oh, I hate that this is happening to me or that this is happening to my family. But more to try to realize. I would say, like, one of the ways of consciously suffering it is to realize that this is all happening. That this isn't what people are doing. This is what's happening because people are unconscious and they're increasingly mechanical. And the real struggle is to wake up, is to see the light, is to allow the light of consciousness to dawn within ourselves, and that would transform everything. That sort of sounds like contrary to what I was saying about the mass of humanity, but in a way, like, it's. It won't happen on a mass level, but the more it happens on the individual level and in terms of collectives and cells, the more chances I think we have to actually avert, like, this disaster that we seem to be headed towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not like everybody has to wake up.
No.
You just need a large enough mass of people that they can somehow affect change at some level and in some way. I mean, I've heard people say, like, you take a civil war or something, like 15% of the population were involved, like it was only small portion of people involved in that or the American Revolution or whatever. But the point is, you don't need the whole masses of humankind. I mean, there may be a great separation of ways. I've heard people, we've heard a lot of kind of psychical predictions for what will happen this year. And one of them is some people say there'll kind of be this great parting of ways, and some will ascend into a higher dimension, and others will kind of pass into the hell worlds, in a sense.
Hmm.
It's funny, I've never bought the idea that the end of the world was in the prophesied in the Mayan calendar and about to arrive on December 21st of this year. Like, to me, it's totally preposterous because they didn't number their years the same way. They didn't have the same terms for the months. The calendar wasn't invented for thousands of years, and then it was modified and reset, and someone kind of arrived at that exact date. I've always believed that was a total hoax. And you look at the Mayan calendar, it's circular. How do they establish a starting point? Like, the whole thing. And I've never read anything that even begins to explain, like, to me, what would be rationally or empirically on what basis they arrived at that date. Like, to me, it's completely fanciful.
Well, you've been reading that Pinchbeck book, right?
Yeah, I finished that book, yeah.
Yeah. I mean...
But, I mean, he doesn't answer my questions about it.
No, but I think what he's pointing to, if I understand him correctly, and I didn't really... it was funny because I liked the book, but... I liked the book a lot, actually. I thought it was very interesting because... He was thinking in sort of mythic dimensions and some ways that are kind of foreign to my kind of way of thinking about things, even about the paranormal and about higher dimensional consciousness. And he was like exploring it in different ways, which I thought was very interesting, you know, not at all the way I would think of it or the way I think that you would think of it. But I thought there was like some real validity to what he was saying. Like at times that, you know, I didn't understand it, to be perfectly frank, at times. But by the same token, what I thought he was getting at was that this isn't happening on Earth so much as it is perhaps in these other worlds or these other dimensions of reality, which are interacting with our world. And that's the way I understood it. Like, I mean, I don't think, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm not really worried about getting up on December 22nd any more than I am any other day, you know? Like, I mean, as you say, it seems completely arbitrary. And, like, I just, there's been, history is replete with all sorts of different prophecies about the end of the world, and so far none of them have been true. Like, you know, like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, as I say, I don't deny that even that there could be these profound changes going on. I just don't think we're going to be aware of them. I don't think we're going to be able to apprehend them with our normal senses. And so there may well be something happening cyclically in the Mayan calendar, which is, you know, it's going to turn things and it's going to initiate a new era or something. But it's not going to it's not going to be literally like, oh, the world's going to come to an end. I think you can, I'll take that bet, you know.
Yeah, and you hear all different kinds of claims, you know, for other people, oh, we're going to enter a photon belt, and, you know.
No, probably not.
All different suggestions, which I don't see any of them. I haven't seen anything that I thought was really scientifically established.
Yeah.
Then it's also another factor becomes then that the significance given to 2012, and it's not just new in terms of, I think it goes back in 1987. Wasn't that the harmonic convergence?
I thought it was 88, but it might have been 87. Yeah, it was around there.
Yeah. And I thought that was arbitrary at the time as well,
yeah.
but in a way it was... It's a way that kind of crystallized some of the kind of new age awareness type stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it was related to Argalus too, wasn't it? Wasn't it? And all tied into this 2012 prediction?
I don't know about that.
I thought it was, but I'm not sure of that. I thought they both came out of the Mayan calendar.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm not sure of that. But anyway, the fact of it having been made such a significant date and issue might also affect certain things because of it being created as this kind of endpoint day. I mean, I always felt it was something that is like the New World Order system kind of having this as an objective to have attained certain position by that date. But I really don't know. It's living in the mystery of it because we'll get a chance to see what unfolds this year. I have no expectations of comets or supernatural happenings.
Yeah, I'm not really...
But there's so much going on at the same time. I feel now like I listened to a radio host who I like to listen to the other day, and he and different people on his show, they were saying like, they were actually saying millions of spacecraft in the outer kind of levels of the around the Earth, like around the Earth and into the atmospheres and so on. And I mean, I don't know about that at all, but I don't completely dismiss it because I feel now like, to me, it's like more and more is unknown. Like, I don't know that that's not possible. You know, and then I saw the other day this interesting Japanese princess who was very kind of regal in her presentation, and she did the YouTube thing, and she recounted, she claimed that there's an advanced civilization in the interior of the Earth, which again is another kind of not, I don't mean to say a myth or a myth means that it's not true, or does that mean it's not true? I mean, that's a long-standing kind of claim. Hey, Jim, you're familiar with that, Hollow Earth theories and you know, different people suggesting that. But it's also, it's like there's such the enigma of UFOs. Like, where do they come from? And I think in a way, in regards to UFOs, like, one possibility is that they're actually aliens from outside the solar system. But another possibility is that there could be advanced beings on the interior of the Earth, and they could have, so they might not be aliens, but from the underworld. I think that's a possibility. And the third is that the elites have their own technologies, which they've developed, and they have a much more advanced space program than we're familiar with. And that, so there are really different possibilities. And
I don't believe any of those possibilities. Well, I wouldn't say I don't believe them. The possibility that makes most sense to me is I think there's equal chance that they're from outer space, or I think they are real, but I think it's more a matter of probably some other dimension, like manifestations from beings from some other dimension. That they're
almost
popping in and out of you know, the material world, like you know, I don't know. I definitely believe that there are spacecraft, quote unquote, and that there are beings and that they have been observed. I do believe that. I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming that you can dismiss 99% of the claims about UFOs, but the 1% are pretty solid, and I haven't really read any satisfying explanation as to what they are, but, you know.
Until somebody actually
produces one and we can actually, you know, really have a conversation, we're not going to know, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's quite possible that they are somehow coming from another dimension.
Yeah. I mean, they almost, in a sense, have to, in the sense that the closest solar system is 4 light years away. So unless, if there were beings from other solar systems, they have to have, then they, I think their transport here has to be through higher dimensions, that it's not in like a physical craft, that somehow it involves that these craft, maybe the craft can materialize and dematerialize or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe there's some sort of like something that is faster than light.
Through hyperspace.
Hyperspace or something.
Which could be at various multiples of the speed of light.
Yeah.
So then, in a way, like these beings could be, in a sense, from higher dimensions, and then they take form. I mean, that was a good fourth kind of possibility. And then the possibility is that it could be all of them simultaneously.
Because
there could be different things going on. I don't know if you've ever seen the series of photographs up on my website. It's on the page about where I put strange sky objects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like those aren't any kind of UFO beings. I'll just tell a little bit of the story of that. Like, looking outside in the sky here in the evening, like I noticed, like there was this. It looked like a star. It looked like a kind of point source, a star, but it was bigger and brighter than the star, and it appeared earlier in the sky. And it was stationary, so it wasn't an airplane because it would be stationary in the same place for hours. And I took pictures of this with the zoom on my camera, which multiplies it like 30 times. And it looks like a little segment of worm, and this thing seems to kind of always be rotating or moving in space. It's very odd. But this became so regular, it would be in the same region of the sky at the same time each night. And I would kind of walk out of the house and I'd kind of wave to it. So I'd say, "Hi, you, whoever that is up there." It's so bizarre. But I don't think it's some kind of alien craft which is coming and sitting up there and you know, like it's not. Yeah. I mean, it's more like they have some advanced spy technology or something, you know. I don't know what it is, you know. I'm at a complete loss because there's all different kinds of things that people see. It's not like they're all consistent what are being seen by people. You know, some people see these kind of massive triangular things, which they say, like the Phoenix Lights, I think, were like this. And they're like absolutely huge. They say like they're 2 or 3 football fields.
Right.
Like they're not small little discs. They're these kind of massive space platforms. There are people who claim those kinds of things, you know. And then sometimes one doesn't know because certain things might be able to be created holographically. Like, perhaps one reason why spaceships move so fast is because there's nothing moving. All they're doing is shifting the angle of the projecting lights.
Well,
so you could create the appearance of a spaceship flying through the sky just by using light beams.
Yeah, I was going to say that there's that too. Like, I mean, it could be holographic projections.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I thought of that too. You know, I was like, I mean, it's funny because I mean, you have that mystery, and then it's like, but you know, then you read Blavatsky, and she says that you know, like, there are entire worlds. Sort of like we're walking through space, you know, and interacting, going to the shopping center, going over to our parents' place, and everything. We're moving back and forth. It's like we're moving through these, through space. And in this space, she says, there are all these other worlds because, you know, they're more subtle and they're blended in with the physical world. And I mean, as fantastic as that seems, like, I mean, really, the material that is emerging from the holographic paradigm is that exactly completely feasible, what she's saying is, you know, I mean, Gurdjieff says exactly the same thing, is that there, you know, that you don't have to go to the sun to study the matter of the sun, it's just within us. These worlds are all interpenetrating and interblending with one another, these higher dimensions, and that's like when people have these experiences of cosmic consciousness, they don't go anywhere, they just go deeper within, and when they go deeper within, they become a more coherent essence, and then that essence becomes one with everything. Somehow holographically, it's possible to know yourself and to know the universe and the gods, which is like far more, I mean, it's even more profound than the idea that we could be visited by spaceships, you know. And I mean,
yeah,
that,
really, it is.
It's much more significant to us. Yeah, and the fact is that people have very convincing accounts of that and very consistent accounts. That's what I was saying. What I was going to say earlier too is that in trying to when I was rereading your material and sort of I was feeling quite inspired about it and reading the material and the near death experience, it's like, I feel like, you know, I'm kind of on the verge of grasping something about all of this that really, like, I feel like I sort of know something about this that I didn't know before, and it's much more real to me now that, there's all these different experiences that people have with these beings of light, and when they pass into these other dimensions, it makes me quite convinced that, you know, when you die, that's not the end. You're not just, you know, a bunch of molecules, and that your eye dissolves with the is coterminous with the end of your physical body. That's it. Like I think you do withdraw into these higher dimensions. I think you do encounter beings of light, and I think, you know, it is possible to go to lower realms. But I think it's the evidence to me is overwhelming because it comes from so many diverse sources. Like it comes from people on drugs. It comes from people who have meditated and fasted and observed these disciplines for years and years. It comes from people who are entirely quote unquote ordinary and then have a near death experience and experience these transformative experiences in these higher dimensions and it comes to people spontaneously without any kind of physiological change or without observing any kind of discipline. The evidence is overwhelming and it's so consistent, like that it can't be describing something that's not real. I feel like it's preposterous to even suggest that this is something that somehow people are hallucinating or something. That's completely idiotic. Like that's like us all hallucinating the moon. How come we're all seeing the same thing? Because it's real, you know.
And I think also the point is that it's like all these evidences, and if what I think they all point to is, like, to summarize it, a multidimensional holographic universe.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what your points lead to.
Yes.
Like what you were saying about Blavatsky, like her idea that there's all worlds and beings within the same space as ourselves, but they pass through us as though invisible to us. Like what she's talking about is a holographic space where it's like you have the angle of the projecting light and you shift the angle of that light and you can see a whole different realm.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of understanding of space.
Yeah.
So then it's multidimensional. Like, you know, it's not that everybody dies and goes to the same place and sees their favorite lord. You know, it's not. That's not the case. There's a complex processes go on subsequent to death, and there are different worlds that people can go into, and it's a much deeper cosmic dimension and experience than most people could even imagine. I mean, people like Gurdjieff and Blavatsky really provide us with such a shocking view of, like, human evolution through, you know, eras and ages and bodies and dimensions. And, you know, it's a grand kind of cosmic tale.
Yeah.
And very profound. And then what we find is that even scientifically, there's all these kinds of evidences that point towards these possibilities.
Yeah, well, I think it's becoming much more feasible scientifically that all of this is, like, I mean, I wouldn't even look to science to validate this, but to be congruent with it, you know, and I think that is, that's emerging. And it's also, like, it's very helpful because it is such a useful, comprehensive perspective to try to unravel scientific enigmas and mysteries and paradoxes and to get a perspective as to how things should be understood scientifically. I think there's great value in that. Like, great dialogue can occur there.
Yeah. There's shocking new theories like the holographic model in physics. And I, you mentioned the last section of that article I wrote, that article series, that the article series Jim's mentioned is in my last book called the Zero Point Teachings book. And the final section of that kind of proposes a model based on Blavatsky of how a human being has a monadic essence that exists within seven-dimensional hyperspace, and it functions as, it has seven micro mini black holes, and this little element in higher dimensional space is like this ultimate information processor, and it has spin properties. And that we all have this kind of higher dimensional physics connected to the human heart. And so in a way, we all have a monad in hyperspace. So it's really a complex model of kind of higher dimensional space, and it tries to relate it to some of the ideas in science, which are making these fantastic possibilities seemingly more possible rather than disproving them. Like, the more physics has advanced, the more strange it's become. With all the new superstring theories and higher dimensions and such, it's all leading more credence to mystical possibilities.
Yeah, compacted dimensions, like seven higher dimensions compacted. Well, actually, I think we're running out of time, but
Yeah, we are. So I would encourage, thanks, Jim. It was an interesting, far-ranging talk today. It was really good. It was animated discussion and some really valuable sections again. And I hope we have a good year. We have a guest next week, and I'll try to find out what happened to Christopher and try to reschedule him for a later date. My website's at www.zeropoint.ca. If anyone were to order my book 1137, I would delay ordering it for a week because I found some typo and edits in it, and I hope by the end of this week to have a slightly revised version. There were some formatting mistakes in the book, but it's a very interesting and controversial work. Okay, thanks, Jim. So we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Okay, yep, thanks, Chris. Thanks.
If you want to go to my website, you can see the links to our guest for next week.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, BBS, and let's pray that we have a good year and hope for the best. Okay, good night.
All right, bye.